Hello and welcome to the March 2010 edition of Hot Type Security Books and Audio, brought to you by SearchSecurity.com and Syngress Publishing. I'm Billy Hurley. As always, our Hot Type podcast bring you free excerpts from recently published information security books, read by the authors themselves. Today's featured authors are Dr. Anton Chuvakin and Brandon Williams, writers of the book PCI Compliance, Understand and Implement Effective PCI Data Security Standard Compliance. Dr. Anton Chuvakin is a recognized information security expert and book author. His information security experience covers PCI DSS, log management, intrusion detection, network forensics, and honeypots. Brandon Williams is the director of the security consulting practice at RSA, the security division of EMC. Brandon is also an adjunct professor at the University of Dallas, Graduate School of Management. Anton, Brandon, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This book here, PCI Compliance, who is the intended audience here? Is it meant for QSAs, IT guys? Who are you targeting here?
I would say that the book is for everybody from an average IT security professional to somebody who is working for either a card brand or a QSA firm. The book really was written to appeal to most everybody who has any connection to payment security or even payment processing. I think that some of the more advanced merchants can directly benefit from reading the book and learning about what controls to implement, how to do it. So we try to write it as with the broadest appeal possible. And that does mean that even somebody who is, quote-unquote, a PCI expert will be able to find some of the stories. I mean, Brandon's case studies are awesome. These are pretty much worth the price of the book in gold. So that's and they would appeal to both advanced audiences and somebody who is just starting with PCI.
And just to be clear, these case studies are these are from actual experiences here?
I'll take yeah. I'll let Brandon handle this one.
yeah, absolutely. So we had to change some of the names, obviously. But yes, I mean, these are all based on actual experiences or things that I've observed during my experiences being a QSA and working with customers on payment security.
Sure. Are there a lot of PCI horror stories that we can hear from in the book?
We prefer not to call them horror stories. We prefer to call them case studies.
So, guys, it's kind of impossible to tackle all of the important aspects of PCI in one short podcast, but let's try to get at a few PCI issues before we have you read from your book. Is end-to-end encryption a mandatory requirement for PCI? Can you clear that up for us? And is that kind of measure a viable one?
I can start on this one and have Brandon have, I'm sure he would have some stuff to add. Certainly the way to phrase a question, is this mandatory, is not the best way because it's not even mentioned in PCI DSS. The whole point, the whole reason you're hearing about this is that that's a recent sort of invention. Well, again, people would even debate the recent angle. That's a way to reduce the scope of PCI by limiting or potentially removing the unencrypted data from the stores and from other places. So this is think of this is not so much of an encryption algorithm, but think of this more as a way to limit the scope where the unencrypted data actually lives in cardholder environments.
People are calling things end-to-end encryption, and they're really not, or they're using it as a way to describe a concept, but without understanding how that concept works. For example, in payment processing, it's virtually impossible to actually get end-to-end encryption. What you can get is you can get something like the point of sale or the PED device to the acquirer. Or, you know, in a hybrid variant with debit processing, you can get back to the issuer, but remember that for every exchange that that transaction goes through, there is a decrypt and re-encrypt based on the working keys that are involved during that transaction. So it's still not end-to-end. It's point-to-point encryption between different areas in the payment system. So end-to-end encryption is definitely a scope reduction technique. And I think the reason why a lot of retailers are looking at it is because of the tremendous cost they're facing in bringing parts of their infrastructure into compliance with PCI and trying to figure out, how do I save money? How do I do things differently? You know, reality is these retailers are becoming payment processors. You know, retailers who do things like, you know, sell goods and services are now being forced to stand up giant IT shops to process payments. That's usually something a financial institution would do. So I think that these guys are really looking for any way that they can to reduce the impact of PCI on their network and allow them to operate in a less restrictive way.
That's a good point. And another hot topic that when it comes to PCI seems to be tokenization. Will tokenization of credit card numbers, how will that satisfy PCI requirements?
Tokenization is simply another way to replace or devalue cardholder data. So it would be used in a similar fashion as an end-to-end encryption concept, where you have a token that's created as soon as the payment is captured from the customer, and that token, which is a meaningless value that you can't back into what the actual card number or any data about the card is, you can't use just that number alone, is then used to authorize up to an acquire or settle or even do clearing and reconciliation with that particular token, as opposed to having the card number.
That's the way to not have the cardholder data. A lot of people who came to PCI field from doing kind of regular information security tend to think and tend to be focused mostly on protecting the data. But in PCI case, or in case of payment security, the more useful approach is to try to not have the data. Because some of the people who are collecting the data, think about your neighborhood gas station, would never, ever, ever be able to protect that data. Mm-hmm. So the only way to have them operate safely is to build a technology in such a way that it allows them to not have the data in the first place.
Now, what kinds of changes should we expect in October's next version of the standard?
Yeah, so they'll start circulating some drafts in the near future here, where we'll have a kind of a better understanding of what plans to be changed. I think maybe we could approach it from a what would I like to see changed.
Sure. What do you think? What do you see them addressing in the next version of it?
I would like to see them address application security a little bit more completely. The way that they've created the clarifications and supplemental content around requirements 6.6 and 11.3 and 11.2 even have kind of taken some of the teeth out of it. I understand that retailers and financial institutions and other enterprises struggle with things like code review. But quite frankly, if you're doing solid code review and you have a good SDLC process and a way to catch bugs before they end up in production, then requirement 11.2, which is the scanning requirement, doesn't seem to be as important anymore. I'd also love to see authenticated scans. That's been an issue ever since the original scanning requirements were released under the KISP and SDP program.
Not from the outside, though, Brandon. You don't want to see this auth scans from the DMZ. That would be kind of silly, right?
But the point is that we've got these quarterly scans that are occurring. Mm-hmm. And whether it's in production, I don't think we should scan production, quite frankly, but some sort of an analog to production.
Yep.
Where we can get an authenticated scan and see what sort of SQL injections across that scripting vulnerabilities can occur behind that authentication screen.
Yeah, most certainly. Because I've seen actually one company, sorry for jumping in, but it's kind of a relevant story, that wanted to do authenticated scanning from the outside, and that caused some pretty intense shock, because I'm like, why would you want to allow your routers and your systems from the outside to let anybody log in with an admin password to do authenticated scanning? So for the internal scans, I would certainly like them to clarify that authenticated scans are allowed and encouraged, but I hope that doesn't make some QSA interpret this as outside or external perimeter scans should be authenticated, because that would be a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, it's all depend on how it's written.
But
even take the administrator user out of it. Just, Anton, you or I go sign up for, pick a website that has an account as a customer, and getting access to the functionality behind that login screen as a user, not even an administrator. I mean, that's to me, when I look at websites that are being scanned for SQL injection and cross-site scripting, it seems like they're missing this massive area where the majority of that dynamic content is created that's customized to a user, where you would have a situation potentially. I mean, shopping carts and catalog pages, you're going to have that issue. But when you look at the amount of functionality and features on a website that occur when a user goes to my account, that's the type of stuff that I think would be great. Whether it's internal or external, doesn't matter. I think it's important to have it scanned. I'd like to see a little bit better on the wireless controls and any wireless, as we talked about in the book, any wireless IPS vendors should just kind of maybe pause for a second, go get a cup of coffee, and come back in a few minutes. I think that looking at how wireless is addressed from a a prevention and detection standpoint inside the standard is pretty weak. I mean, suggesting that companies go quarterly to all their locations and do a handheld sweep is a pretty weak way to identify devices on the network. I think there's better ways to do it, whether it's from the wire, and you're looking at positively identifying devices sitting on the LAN through something like SNMP, or whether it's putting an IDS, IPS that is a wireless enabled in the stores. I mean, the cost is really not the issue. I think what the issue is the management.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that discovery, I mean, one of the controversial issues that Brendan kind of did mention is the discovery, right? Remember there was a discussion about whether they should mandate the cardholder data discovery? So
yep.
I'm a bit of on the fence about this one. So on a good day, I think that it's a hugely useful idea that would make people actually know what's going on. And on the other end, I see that this requirement might cause huge resistance from the merchants because they would be a bit afraid that their scope would increase by a huge percentage. So I almost feel like maybe they should look into this, but it's a bit of a high-risk requirement.
Just I would say that if there was a little bit more clarity around discovering that data using, you know, manual or automated tools but outlining a process. They didn't outline a process. They just kind of said you have to use manual or automated tools.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's interesting you say that search for clarity because in your book you mention 8 specific PCI myths and misconceptions. And I think this is a good time for why don't you take us through about 2 of those and read us a few excerpts from your book.
Okay, I can do myths. I actually have a chapter open right here. So security breaches make PCI irrelevant. I mean, this myth is probably the one that causes the most rage and caused the most rage when I was writing the book because there's absolutely nothing true about this. So let me read some sections from this. Myth number 4, breaches prove PCI DSS irrelevant. Myth number 4 seems mostly driven by the media. It claims that recent card data breaches prove PCI irrelevant. We suspect it stems from the fact that reporting failures and other bad stuff typically draws more listeners, readers, and watchers compared to reporting successes, and that attracts more media attention. Sorry, no offense to any of the media listeners we have, including the present party. Note how much press time the catastrophes, corrupt politicians, and various technology failures get. The bigger the better. However, it encourages many organizations to develop a negative, destructive mindset and thus to do a bad job with PCI DSS and data security. As a result, they would suffer from a devastating data breach, which is more than a little ironic, since they were trying to focus on the breaches, not on compliance. Breaches of organizations which validated their PCI compliance should get more people to focus on security, as well as on maintaining compliant and secure state, not the other way around. If somebody got breached, you now need to do a better job to not end up like that organization. It's worthwhile to mention that QSAs carry part of the blame as well. Cases where blatant security mistakes, severe configuration weaknesses, forbidden data storage, and even compromised systems are missed by the easy grader assessor who focused much more on writing a report and not enough on actually collecting data for the report. Again, reality is exactly the opposite. Data breaches remind us that basic security mandated by PCI DSS is necessary, but not sufficient. You have to start from the basics before you can advance in your security education. As you learn more about security, you usually come to realize that nothing guarantees breach-free operation.
All right, thanks a lot. I think that's a good preview of what we can expect from the book PCI Compliance, Understand and Implement Effective PCI Data Security Standard Compliance, written by Dr. Anton Chivakin and Brendan Williams, published by Syngress Publishing. To learn more and to check out our other information security podcasts, visit our podcast page at certsecurity.com/podcast. I'm Billy Hurley. Thanks for listening.